Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's just 2 days until tax day, everyone. Yeah, it's strange to say that in July, but the novel coronavirus pandemic has rendered just about everything upside down, including the so-called economic recovery Americans were supposed to be feeling right about now. The real economy is dragging, while COVID cases are skyrocketing in the United States. So what better time to bring back our favorite economic analysts, Michelle Singletary and Rana Faruhar? Rana Faruhar is global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times, and she's also a CNN global economic analyst and author of Don't Be Evil and Makers and Takers. Rana, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Michelle Singletary, she's joining us from Bowie, Maryland. She's a personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, and her column is The Color of Money. It's syndicated in newspapers nationwide. She's also the author of The 21-Day Financial Fast. Michelle, it's great to have you back as well.
Oh, always glad to be here.
I should say this is our fourth time together since March, I think. We should start. We need to come up with a name for the Michelle and Rana Hour, I guess. Do you guys have any good ideas?
Macro, micro.
We'll just start calling it On Point with Michelle and Rana, and I'll just take a backseat and be a listener. But listen, so since this is our fourth time together, I just wanted to start by playing something, Michelle, that you said last time when we were all together on June 15th, so just barely, almost a month ago. So here's what you said, Michelle.
The market started to go up and people like, okay, we're back. And so, but there's a disconnect between how the market is responding and what's going to happen in real-time reality in terms of all those folks who have lost their jobs.
Right.
Some of them won't go back to jobs, or they will, maybe they had a full-time job and then they've got to piece together two or three jobs. So there might be folks listening thinking, well, I'm okay. My portfolio, it's not back 100%, but it's still pretty, it's up. And I can just breathe. But just like with the virus, we've got to remember that this is not over yet.
Okay. So Michelle, that was you a month ago. And I have to admit, so I'm lucky enough to have a 403B and a little bit to save for my kids 529. And yesterday, for the first time since March, I dared to look. Like I literally like held my hands over my eyes and like and through a crack between my fingers, I looked and I was like, oh. So yeah. It did seem that at least that little part of my portfolio like hadn't reached the nadir. It was like on its way up. And I don't know whether I should feel relieved or not, Michelle. What are we supposed to make of this?
You know, I had the exact same experience. I had not been looking because what's the point? And then my husband and I looked last night. We were going over finishing up our taxes. And he said, come look. And I said, oh, I can't. And it is back to where it was before it took that nosedive in March. And you feel this sort of, just like you said, this like Jekyll and Hyde. One of it's like, yay. And the other one's like, what? So because you're thinking, what is going on here? And, you know, it's just the market is just not reflecting the economy anymore. And I just don't know what to do. And I'm sure lots of people are out there feeling the same way. You know, you want to rejoice, but you also have this sinking feeling that there's going to be something, you know, a crash coming again, because it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it does. I mean, so, you know, Rana, you've been talking a lot about like what kind of recovery will we have? Well, at least for the markets for now, the markets are having that V-shaped recovery.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, as Michelle was talking, I was thinking it is Jekyll and Hyde, and it's really about the fortunes of companies versus the fortunes of individuals, consumers, citizens, workers. And those things are really different. They didn't always used to be. You know, there was a time at which when markets were going up, that the real economy would be essentially in a pretty good place as well. But for the last couple of decades in particular, there's been a real divergence because companies, as we've talked about before, can fly 35,000 feet over the problems that are happening on the ground in various communities. You know, they can still make a lot. The S&P 500, you know, still makes 60% of its revenues from overseas, most of those companies. And there are countries abroad that are actually doing better with the virus, starting to be in recovery. So there are some real things that are influencing the markets on the upside. There's also, of course, all that easy money that's coming from the Fed, all that monetary stimulus, which, you know, the Fed's doing the best they can, but all they can do is add money to the markets. They cannot change the story on Main Street. And that's something we keep coming back to, but it's such a profound thing for people to really understand.
Yeah, so we'll talk about what's actually happening on Main Street with small businesses in just a little bit, because I definitely want to hear from both of you on that. But about the markets and the weird disconnect here, people really love hearing you guys on the show. So we got some questions from listeners based on what you said last time. So Rana, listener Brenda from Burlington, Vermont, she left us this question for you.
I was hoping that Meghna would ask Rana to follow up on her comments that she made in March about the changes in the financial market since the 1970s and the disconnect between share prices and the state of the economy. And in particular, what, if any, implication does this have for individual investors and in particular those of us with IRA retirement accounts?
Yeah. So, Rana, what do you think?
Show to answer that question. first of all, I'm actually in Vermont. So hello to this listener. I'm in Manchester enjoying a couple of weeks away from New York. So here's what's happening. Basically, since the 1980s, globalization has allowed American companies, but all big multinational companies, to go out into the global marketplace to put workers wherever it was cheapest to do so, to put capital wherever it was most tax efficient to do so, and to sell to consumers everywhere. That was great for them. They get all the advantages of globalization, which is one of the reasons why companies are taking a greater percentage of the overall economic pie than ever before. You know, if you look at the corporate share of the economic pie relative to either the government share or certainly relative to the labor share, it is at post-World War II highs. But that has not created more income for the average person. I mean, wages have been stagnating across the board since the early 1990s for some groups of people. Working class folks with just a college degree, they've been stagnating really since the late 60s, early 70s. So there is this disconnect now. Now, what does that mean for you as an investor? This is where it gets really interesting, because sometimes what might be good for the economy and what might be good for raising wages and for actually creating, I think, a more sustainable growth paradigm for generations to come, that might actually be bad in quotation marks, for share prices in the short term. And this is what happens when you look at, for example, sometimes when Joe Biden will give an economic speech and he'll talk about how, you know what, big corporations and rich individuals might have to pay more in taxes. And then you see the markets take a dip. And is that bad for the markets? Well, the markets don't like it because corporate profit margins will be squeezed. And, you know, that means that corporations may have to tighten their very large belts a little bit. But is it good for the economy longer term? Will it be good for stocks in 10 years, 20 years? I think yes. So that's what we're getting at. It's kind of about timeline, short term versus long term. I could go on and say what I'm doing with my own portfolio right now, but maybe I'll stop right there and let Michelle jump in.
Wait, okay, we're gonna have to come back to that, because one of my favorite conversations from last year, Rana, was with you when you just like pulled it all out and went 100% money market. We'll talk about that in a second, but Michelle, go ahead.
Well, you know, oh God, I love talking to two strong, intelligent women. It's just like I'm on such a high when I'm doing this show. So, you know, I sort of take a different tack than Anna in terms of getting totally out. And I think that's what Brenda and so many other people are saying. Well, I've got to have some growth. And here's the reality. Because the Fed is in there trying to goose the economy, you know, interest rates are just at historic lows, right? You can't put your money in the bank and keep pace with inflation. And so unless you've got a real good cushion that you can weather increases in the in inflation, you've got to have some growth. And that's the sad part about this, is that this, what's happening now, this disconnect, is forcing a lot of investors to take more risk than they probably should or are comfortable with, because you just can't put it in the bank, and you certainly can't put it in your mattress. And I think that's the sad part. But before, I think that's what Rana was talking about, there was diversity in how we could invest, right? Those who are saying, I can't take these ups and downs. My financial situation is too perilous. I'm living on the edge. I might have some cushion, but not enough to weather a 2 or 3 year downturn. And so they can't turn to anything other than the stock market. And I think that's what Brenda's talking about. And a lot of people who are near retirement, in retirement, feeling this sort of, whoa, that I can't sleep. And yet I know I need growth. This is what all these smart people are telling me. And that's, I wish I had the answer for that. And all I can say is what I'm doing in my life is there's a lot of things you can do, you know, not carry a lot of debt for one thing, you know, save as much as you can in an emergency fund for job losses and disruption in your income, and then still put some money in the market and just pray and hope that somehow this disconnect is not as wide as it is right now. So that's what we're doing. And that's all I can tell you. I'm not a financial planner. I'm not, you know, I don't look at the markets like Rana does every day, but that's what I do. I keep my debts low. I keep my expenses low. You know, I try to, I'm helping other people in my community, and I'm still investing for my retirement. And the upside of that is if it goes into that W or it tanks, I'm not carrying a lot of debt. I only have my mortgage, so I can weather that storm. You know, I'm living below my means so that if I say I'm done, I'm in a money market, I can still pay for the things that I need.
Yeah. So I think that idea of living below our means and not getting drunk on debt is great advice on the individual level, also on the corporate level as well. You know, I was also just thinking to the two of you, like maybe investors could look to the bond markets. But I remembered earlier this year we touched that negative yield rate with some bonds. So who knows what's happening there? We've got so much more to talk about with Michelle Singletary and Rana Faruhar, two of our favorite economists. This is our fourth time together. We'll talk about where they see the economy headed in the next couple of months. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We have brought back Michelle Singletary and Rana Faruhar, two of our favorite economics and finance analysts, to check in with them on where they see the economy headed over the next couple of months. They have been our guides multiple times during you know, these unprecedented times. I hate using that cliche, but it does feel right given what 2020 has been so far. Now, Michelle and Rana, what I'm going to do here is I want to give the listeners who sent us questions their due, because usually I save those till the end of the show and then they get short shrift. So I want to go through a couple of more listener questions for you, and then we'll dig deep into what's happening on Main Street, what the economic recovery, if and when it ever comes, might look like, depending on who you are, all sorts of those big picture issues. But first, let's listen to Zeke from Houston, Texas. He wants to know what both of you think about what he did with his money at the start of the pandemic.
I would like to say that at the beginning of the pandemic, I took out a significant amount of money from the stock market index funds. But now I'm starting to wonder if that was the right move considering that the Fed, and it seems like the federal government, is propping up the stock market artificially. And I'm not sure if there's ever going to be a correction, or if it was just a better move to, you know, stay very, very aggressive in the stock market and allow, you know, these equities to keep rising.
That's Zeke from Houston, Texas. And Rana, I was smiling the whole time because you were talking about that easy money from
the
Fed.
I love that question, because Zeke is like, you know, he clearly sees very correctly what's happening. So here, and I'm going to come clean. As you know, Magna, I broke the news on this show. I actually pulled my money out last August because I was very, very concerned about exactly the things we're talking about: record corporate debt, deglobalization, an unstable political situation in the U.S. You know, I could go on and on and on. But to me, it felt like if I look at the real story, not that artificial, you know, what the Fed is doing to bolster asset prices story, but if I look at the real story, it looks very shaky. And it has done for several years. I mean, I wrote my whole first book, Makers and Takers, about how I thought that American business was being undermined by the financial markets and by the amount of debt that was being pushed onto corporations, the amount of risk companies were taking, the short-termism. All that is still true. So, as always, there are sort of, when you're investing, there's kind of two stories you need to think about. First, you develop a thematic story about what is really going on in the world. And that story is the one we're talking about. It's a story of vulnerability. Then there's this bizarro world of the Fed and the financial markets and the sort of immediate market paradigm. And that's very, very difficult to time. I mean, you know, even for the greatest investors, I mean, Stan Druckenmiller, one of the greatest investors of all time, just a few months ago said, you know, I think this is the riskiest market of all time. I'm out. Well, he's had to issue a mea culpa to some of his big deal investors for getting the timing wrong. It's possible to get the timing of when a correction is coming wrong. That's very, very difficult to time. But is there another correction coming? I believe that there is. I believe that firmly. And I just look, frankly, at history. I try to be a student of history when it comes to the markets, and you get these big pendulum shifts. And I believe that we are at one of those pendulum shifts now. And, you know, I'll just briefly say, From basically from the 1930s to the 1970s, that was one paradigm. We had the New Deal. We had, you know, we had a big financial crisis in 1929. Then we re-regulated the financial system until about the 70s. It was safer. I think you had more inclusive growth. You had a connection between Main Street and Wall Street, where all boats really were rising. Then you started to get deregulation, a more financialized, saccharine kind of a growth, globalization, tech-based job disruption, all that disconnected the fortunes of companies and consumers and got us to the place where we are now, where we are just at this incredible extreme. And COVID has, of course, put kerosene on that fire. I mean, just look at the unemployment numbers. We haven't even gotten into the picture with small business now, but I do believe the pendulum will shift. I can't predict when the timing will be, but I think we will see another big market correction.
So,
Michelle, I wanted to give you a chance to chime in there. Go ahead.
Well, I think all of what Rana said was true. And the one thing that I think that you should latch on is the inability for average people and even the experts to time the market.
Time the market,
so
exactly.
If you decide that I want out, then you should have a sort of a plan for it and not react to what's happening in the market. That's what a lot of people did during the Great Recession. And as we know, like what, in March 2009, the stocks fell by what, 45%, but a year later, it had all recovered. So right. You just decide at I want to take your wins when you want to take your wins, if you want to get out, but you can't time this crazy market. And that's what, you know, my husband and I had this conversation last night. I said, honey, look, I'm out at a certain point. And so we've been just talking about not completely out, but, you know, we want to take our wins and lock them in. And that's how we're doing it. We're not looking at what's happening with the market, but at what point are we saying, okay, you know what? We've made a good amount. We're going to be okay. We don't have any debt. We're going to pay off our house before we retire. We'll be good. And that's the conversation we're having. So it's less about what the market is doing and what my needs are, what our needs
are. That's, and I think that's what you should important. Do. That's very important. I love, Michelle, I love that advice, because in a way it's good news for Zeke either way. If you know, stay in, depending on your timeline, you're fine either way. I mean, I feel okay about having, I have some money in gold right now. I have some in property. I have a lot in cash. I'm waiting. I think there will be another dip and I will get back in a more targeted way. And I can talk more about that if folks want to hear, but it's okay. When the dip comes, if you want to get back in, you can. If we get a dip and you're still in, fine, as long as you're willing to ride it out for 5-10 years, you know, I mean, or it could be less than that, but you know, you just can't think about it quarter to quarter. I think that's what Michelle's saying. You have your goals, your big picture goals, and you stick with them.
That's right. Well, absolutely right. That's what you have to do.
Yeah. Well, so here, speaking of big picture goals, actually, we have a listener from Chicago. This is Patrick Gibson. He left us a voicemail asking the two of you about becoming a first-time homeowner during these times.
My wife and I are relative newlyweds, and we are in the process of thinking about purchasing our first home. And we'd like some advice. Is this the right time? Should we have a fair amount of savings? Should we be putting that towards a down payment on a home? Should we be thinking about other usages? Any advice you could give? Obviously, the circumstances given the pandemic, we know we want to be homeowners at some point, but we're a bit unsure whether this is the correct time. So we would love to hear your advice.
That's Patrick from Chicago. Michelle, do you have any words for him?
I do, and it might not quite be the trajectory that he's looking for. So when everyone asks me if this is the right time for them to buy a house, I ask them a bunch of questions, which hurts their little hearts. So the first question I ask, do you have any other debt? Do you have a car loan? Do you have student loan debt, especially student loan debt? Any debt, and if you have any debt, and I mean that, any debt, credit card debt, except for, you know, well, we wouldn't have a home, then I would say no. I get out of all of that debt before you buy the house, including a car. Now, the banks will say you can carry a certain amount of debt and buy a home. Sure, go ahead. But I feel like you put yourself in a better position when you walk into that home without any debt other than that mortgage. And so that's the first question. And most people can't answer no to that question. And so that ends the conversation.
Michelle,
there.
I've got it. Can I just, yeah, well, I was going to say, can I just, I'm so sorry to jump in here, but I'm just thinking, student loan debt? I mean, you've essentially just cut out a huge number of Americans from thinking that they can own a home for until they're possibly retired, because it's going to take them so long to retire that student loan debt.
We may see a debt jubilee, I think,
on student loans.
Well, here's the thing. If we all went with that rule, right? So when you're deciding to take on that debt, you will say to yourself, if I take on this enormous amount of student loan debt, then I am not going to be able to buy a house until I'm in my 50s or 60s. So then what does that do? That changes your decision making. And so I know that I'm way out there and people may think that I am crazy. But what I'm telling you is, just like with corporate debt, we're taking on too much debt. And that decision has to be made over a 10, 20, 30 year life. So when you take on even your home loan, your car loan, your student loan, you need to think down the road, can I continue to carry this if something happens to my job. And I will not tell you something that I did not do myself. I've had three homes in my lifetime, and neither time when I bought those homes did I have any debt at all, not even a car loan. And so that means when you walk in that door, you're free. Now, here's how you get rid of that debt. You stay where you are. You put all the money that you possibly can on that debt, even if it means pulling back on some of your retirement, especially if you're younger, because you have some time to build that up. So all those kids and students who are graduating in May, I say, if you can, go back home and live 4 or 5 years. If you've got a massive amount of student debt, get it done. And then you can save and move into your house. That's what my daughter graduated with her master's. She's coming back home. And we said, baby, live here for 5 or 6 years. Save your salary, 90% of your salary. And when that time period is up, which is a microscopic amount of time in your lifetime, you can buy your home out. Right. Or at least put enough down that you have a tiny mortgage. That is a game changer.
Without a doubt.
Magna, can I jump in and add,
first of all,
I can never argue with the logic of Michelle's financial planning. And really what you're talking about is moving from the conventional wisdom that we're always pushed towards as Americans to be consumers, you know, to be debtors, to be consumers. You're talking about moving towards being a saver, towards being a planner and an investor. And that's awesome. I do think it's an interesting time, though, to go to the listener's question about buying property. We are already seeing an utter collapse in commercial real estate prices. And that's because the pandemic, basically, you know, cities are evacuated. People are working from home. Companies have realized, you know what? Do we really need this expensive office space in downtown Manhattan or San Francisco and Boston? You know what? Maybe not. I suspect that that market is not going to come back. That is already in New York, where I live, having a huge effect on the residential market in places like Manhattan. I suspect it will do the same in other big cities. Conversely, you're seeing bidding wars now and property prices skyrocketing in suburban areas. So it's sort of a reverse migration to what we've seen in the last few years, where everybody wanted to live in cities. Now nobody wants to live in cities. So there's incredible volatility right now in the property markets. Volatility is both an opportunity and a challenge.
If you've got a super high risk tolerance, sure.
It's an interesting moment. I do think, as we talk about that pendulum shift, I think real estate prices in major urban areas may have reached peaks similar to equity prices. I think that you may start to see a downturn in the 12 markets or so that have represented the majority of housing gains since the financial crisis. I think you may see those trending downwards now.
Great. I just love that, given the fact that I bought here in the Boston area.
It's all about the long term. Sit on Michelle. Don't worry.
I'm going to be in where I am till kingdom come, let me tell you. Okay. Now, listen, I want to turn our attention to, you know, away from the markets and to the real economy where by far most Americans are, that they're living and experiencing here. And listen, we've had a couple of job reports where things were clawing back here. But I was looking at a really interesting Morgan Stanley report, I think, from late last week that said that we could be on the precipice of more jobs being shed yet again because small businesses are looking at the end of the loans that they receive from the federal government. They're not going to be able to make payroll. So long story short, a longer than expected downturn for folks. And so, Michelle, I think this is something I want to explore a lot with both of you in some detail, that the markets, again, they're doing their V-shaped thing for now, but what most people are really experiencing right now comes nowhere near to feeling that we're at the beginning of a recovery.
Right. Yeah, it's true. And then and we've said this on the program before. We have to also remember that there are many, many people who are not in the market. So what the market does have no bearing on in terms of their, you know, investment portfolio that is non-existent. So, yeah, you know, this I was talking to my editor about that because we did a huge retirement package when in the middle of all of this, and it did so well because people were very interested. And we are going to try to do something again this fall, because I said, listen, the end of the summer is the time where everything's going to hit the fan. You know, the extra $600 a month that was given for unemployment, it ends at the end of this month, right? The eviction moratoriums are going to be ending unless there's something happening in Congress. And we see what's happening in Congress, which is, you know, nothing. And so I think the summer, end of summer and fall is going to be a crucial time. And I think there's going to be more suffering as particularly if we don't get control over this virus and businesses can't boot up. And even if they boot up, many people are still scared to go out, as they should be. Right. We rush to go out. And now, I mean, I see pictures of people walking around, and I go to the grocery store, try to go at different odd hours because I feel like there's just still too many people, even though we're all in masks. And it's just not worth risking your life. And so I think we are headed for a tough time at the end of the summer and into the fall. And I don't, you know, I don't know what else to tell people, that you just got to hunker down because it's going to be tough.
I think, Ronna, let me just give some. Can I just add some? Ahead. Can I just add a couple of numbers here? Because I just to remind folks that in May and June, the economy did pick up over 7 million jobs, which was great. But that's barely a third, maybe even less than a third than the number that had been lost up until that point. And then, of course,
and
as Michelle rightly points out. Oh, no, go ahead, Michelle. I was just going to say,
no,
go,
but
ahead, go ahead.
I just wanted to add context in that. But there is some look at that numbers, and that it's not new jobs or creation of jobs. Isn't
right.
it just people going back to work?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And then as you pointed out, at the same time, we have COVID numbers spiking in many, many states across the country, meaning that the pandemic is obviously nowhere near being under control. Now, listen, we've just got about a minute, Ronna, before we have to take another break here.
Yeah,
but
so
I want to give you a shot at this.
My quick 60-second take here. All this makes sense to me. I think that those May-June numbers were about the demand surge that comes from it's summer. We had a certain amount of opening up in certain amount of states. You're now seeing the virus picking up in western and southern states. You're seeing, just as Michelle said, the end of the PPP. That's been extended 1 week, so that'll end in August 8th. At that point, you've got basically the majority of small businesses in this country will not be able to make payroll or make their businesses go for more than 2 weeks. You're starting to see the move from a kind of layoff situation to these are permanent job losses that we're seeing. And some economists are saying that 40% of the job loss is going to be permanent.
I'm just going to jump in here for a second because we do have to take that quick break. And we're speaking with Ronna Farrughar and Michelle Singletary. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we will be speaking with the hosts of the podcast Call Your Girlfriend about what they call society's most underappreciated relationship. That's friendships. And we want to hear your stories about those deep, enduring friendships that have sustained you across the years and even now in the era of the COVID pandemic across distance? How have you overcome obstacles and rough patches in those friendships over the years? And what has that friendship meant to you? How has it changed your life? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking once again with two of our favorite economics and finance analysts. Rana Faruhar is Financial Times global business columnist and associate editor. She's also CNN's global economic analyst and author of Don't Be Evil and Makers and Takers. And Michelle Singletary is also with us. She's a personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Her column, The Color of Money, is nationally syndicated across the country, and she's also author of the 21-Day Financial Fast. Now, Rana, before the break, I'm sorry I had to cut you off there, but we were talking about what the recovery, if any, might look like. Can we focus a little bit more on, I want to hear your thoughts about especially small businesses, because they are the engine of job creation, of speedy job creation in this country. I mean, do you see small businesses continuing to have a rough time, say, in the next 3 or 4 months?
100%. I think unless we see a major new fiscal aid program, you're going to see a lot of them go under. The statistics are really very startling. The majority of small businesses have 2 weeks of cash on hand. A lot of them, if they don't get a renewed PPP, and I don't mean just grants or loans, but loan forgiveness. I mean, you know, these companies, we've been talking a lot about debt. Small businesses, they don't have the resources even that large companies do. I mean, large companies shouldn't be taking on the amount of debt that they have, but they can at least go to the global capital markets. Small businesses are rooted in their communities. Many of them are really not geared up for this virtual world that we've been forced to live in because of the pandemic. They're high touch businesses. You know, I look around, I'm actually in Vermont, as I mentioned earlier, having a little bit of break time, and I see restaurants trying to open up, trying to do some outdoor seating. But even then, you're talking about 50% capacity at the most. You cannot make your margins. You cannot make your payroll work with those kinds of figures. So I think we are going to see a mass culling of small businesses. And what that is going to do is create more concentration in an economy that was already very concentrated. You know, that's the economic issue of our time, wealth inequality, the fact that so much wealth lives in so few hands. You know, just a couple of statistics that always kind of blow my mind. 80% of corporate wealth before the pandemic was in 10% of companies. These are the big tech companies, the big banks. You know, post-pandemic, I bet you that's going to shift to 90%, 5%. You know, it's going to be even more concentrated. And that's why I think if we do get a new administration in November, I think that you're going to see some real shifts in the way companies are regulated around antitrust, around tax. I mean, I'm actually very heartened by some of the statements that Joe Biden's put out in the last couple of days about supporting small business and really trying to enrich that ecosystem. It's going to be a bloodbath, I think, unless we do something about this.
Well, we'll talk more about proposals, economic proposals from both the campaigns in just a second. But Michelle, if feel free to comment on my question about small businesses. But I also wanted to add in another factor that's so real here in the United States, that when we talk about job losses and then recoveries historically, and also with this pandemic, those recoveries have been very unequal in terms of who recovers the fastest, right? I'm just looking at some data that was compiled by the Wall Street Journal recently, and it found that Hispanic workers thus far, they were hit disproportionately hard by closures, by business closures. They have been one of the quickest groups to return to work. Black workers lost jobs at the second fastest rate. And they have returned to work more slowly than white workers thus far, and those white workers incurred the smallest decline in jobs. And we're still talking about millions of Americans here, but there's just an unequal recovery baked into the cake in the United States.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons is obviously the hardest hit industries have been the service industries, which has a high concentration of both Hispanic and Black workers. And they return because services returning, but then also they are lower paid, less likely have health insurance, all the benefits that many of us who work for corporations have, retirement plans and things like that, the ability to work from home. We keep talking about this whole surge and people working from home, but really that's going to be more concentrated in people who have the kinds of jobs that you can work at home. You can't work at home if you're a restaurant worker. You can't work at home if you, you know, work in a Macy's or some sort of retail shop. And that's what disturbs me so much when we have this conversation about, you know, more help or aid. There's this this idea that if we boost unemployment for workers, even keeping that extra $600 on the table, that this is going to be an incentive for people to stay home. Therefore, we should not help them. And it's just idiotic that if you ever talk to anyone who is unemployed or has been unemployed, which I do far more than the people who are actually putting in policies, they don't want to sit at home and they know that this check is going to end. So who in their right mind would turn down a full-time job that is going to have, you know, a stable income to stay at home for a couple of weeks for this extra $600. It just nobody in their right mind would do that. And that's a false narrative. And so if we are going to have a recovery package, we have got to consider all those workers that you talked about. And then this brings us circles us right back to this idea of healthcare and all those things that should be on the table that would help people during times like this. So we can't just talk about COVID-19 in this little box that once we cure this virus, everything will be glorious. Because it wasn't before, you know, and we've got to look outside of that box that, yeah, we're all rooting for that vaccine, but that's still, that will cure that one virus, but it won't cure the economic virus that has been in our economy and will stay in our economy until we find a vaccine to make sure people have a living wage, health care, and a safety net for when we have these types of downturns in the economy.
100%. I mean, you know, just to talk about who's lost their jobs and who hasn't, there was in the very beginning of COVID, there was this weird jobs report. I don't know if you all remember, but we had skyrocketing unemployment numbers, but wages actually went up. Well, that's because the only people that had jobs were the kind of high skill virtual workers, people like the three of us that can actually do our job here from, you know, on these calls and not have to leave the house. Everybody else that actually has to go out into the workforce, you know, these are the people that were hurt most. Service, healthcare, you know, the, I mean, either in terms of public health or in terms of unemployment. It's interesting because COVID, as always, there's opportunity in challenge. I mean, we can just look at what's happened, and it's such a clear scrim that's been pulled back on the vulnerabilities. You know, we need healthcare for all. We need a plan for a 21st century workforce. We need more resiliency. We need less focus on efficiency and sort of quarterly profits. And we need a 5, 10, 20 year plan. The countries that have that, by the way, are doing better. I mean, Germany, case in point, is doing very well because it has that kind of resiliency, that kind of sharing of burden between public sector companies and labor. And that's something I think we're going to hear a lot about in the presidential campaigns.
Okay, so a sharing of burden and then perhaps even also of wealth between capital and labor. I know this is something that both of you want to talk about, but Rana, in June when we had you on, just again, barely a month ago, regarding about what could happen in the next 4 months, here's what you said.
I pray to God, you know, after November, we're going to get a real national competitiveness strategy that starts to do what banks can't do, what politicians and companies must do together, which is think about what kind of economy do we want to have going forward? How do we create more resiliency, not focus on the short term, just make things as efficient as possible, outsource to the cheapest places, use software, downsize, don't think about human capital. We need to stop thinking about capital. There's plenty of that washing around the system. We need to think about human capital.
Okay, so capital, you mentioned.
It sounded familiar. I was intellectually coherent from this time before. That's always good when you don't contradict yourself.
And consistent. And consistent as well. So let's dig into the beginnings of the economic proposals that we're seeing. At least from the Biden camp. So here is what former Vice President Joe Biden said in a speech he gave last week, laying out his economic plan.
If I'm fortunate enough to be elected president, I'll be laser focused on working families, the middle class families I came from here in Scranton, not the wealthy investor class. They don't need me, but working families do. And this may be, should be, in my view, the guiding principle. We must reward work as much as we've rewarded wealth, but now we just reward excessive wealth.
Former Vice President Joe Biden last week. Now, Rana, I would say that it's pretty easy for him to say that, but how should that translate into actual policy in the event if the vice president, the former vice president, wins in November?
Well, you know, there were a couple of statements that the Biden campaign put out a couple days ago, one about supply chains, one about high-tech manufacturing. I think he's on the right track. I think this idea of rewarding work, not wealth, I mean, there's a lot packed in there. A couple of things I think you're probably going to see. He's already said you're going to see a rollback of the Trump tax reform. And I put reform in quotation marks because really it was just a corporate tax boondoggle. I would imagine, and all this, of course, is predicated on how Congress looks. If you got a Democratic sweep, it would be easier for policy to get through. Let's assume that that was the case. I think you'd see a rethink about how we tax dividends and capital wealth versus how we tax wages from paychecks, which is the way most of us actually survive. I think that you're going to see supply chains being looked at carefully, and that's going to be a tricky line to get right, because I said this in my first book. I have for a long time thought that we should look much more carefully at the ecosystem at home, and that we should try and not be protectionist, but think about how to keep the skills that we need so we can have the wages that we need. Again, like countries like Germany have made policy changes around this at home to a certain extent, because you simply cannot have an economy that is made up only of software developers and hedge funders and people flipping burgers. You know, that just does not work. You've got a 70% consumer spending economy. You've got to have income growth. So I think that he's starting to think about how that's going to happen. It's going to be tricky. You're going to have to get into things like foreign policy, defense policy to get all this right. But I think vectorally, he's on the right track.
Well, Michelle, if I can just jump in here, I mean, the President Trump would argue that the focus of his economic efforts have been, well, on that tax cut that came early on in his presidency, on cutting regulations so that it's easier for business to do business so that they can hire folks.
Except they don't do that, right? They buy back their stocks. They increase pay to their upper management. You know, what we have a market where it used to be, not so much now, that when you laid off people, your stock prices went up. So I love what Rona said, that we've got to look at a different type of economy and look at what happened with COVID. Just look at this. The type of things that we needed that we couldn't get because we don't produce here, masks and ventilators and things like that. And when we talk about middle class America, I think we need to, you know, change our language, because to me, that still doesn't capture the people on the lower side of even middle, you know, low income to moderate income. And so we've got to look at minimum wage. We've got to look. We keep talking about healthcare. And it's like, no one's listening. We had to talk about equal pay for women and minorities. We have to talk about job training, being able to send people to get skills to work in manufacturing so that they can earn a decent wage, right? I mean, we have lost so many manufacturing jobs where people could support their families and send their kids to college, maybe with a little bit of loans, but they could send them and not be broke. And they could live in retirement because they had some pensions. And so they weren't as much of a, and I don't want to say this burden in a sense of, you know, if you receive Social Security, you're a burden, but you had a pension and Social Security. So together, those two things could help you live through your retirement. And so much of your money wouldn't have to be at risk in the market. So if we're going to talk about
a new economy, and he's not going to be looking at the wealthy families. Like, look at all of that, that whole package to be sure that we can go forward. And I just wish and pray that we get rid of this consumerism thing that is driving us, you know, buy, to the point where people don't have the cash reserves when times get tough or the economy goes for a downturn, because it will. That's just how it cycles. And I just, that's a hard sell when you're saying, well, stop, Michelle, like, at Christmas time. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry to jump in here, but I completely, no, I don't ever want to be the one to stop you, but I just wanted to say, like, we just heard Rana bring back that number, which is so telling, I think, that it is a consumer-driven economy as a whole, right? 70%. So the change that you're asking for would be a fundamental change to how we construct or believe what a healthy economy should look like for this country.
And you know what? That's what we have to do. And if nothing else, I think this virus, for me, it said, let's stop and pause and look at what we're doing. And this is an opportunity. It's been horrible that so many people have been sick and died. But let's turn this around so that we learn the lesson finally, right? On this pause that we've been unfortunately given with this virus, let's shake everything up. Right? Because when are we ever going to do that? And if this is what had to happen, let's take that advantage and fundamentally change our economy. Yeah.
100%.
Well, Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist at The Washington Post, her column, The Color of Money, syndicated nationwide. Michelle, thank you so much as always.
You're so welcome.
And Rana Faruhar, global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times, author of Don't Be Evil in Makers and Takers. Rana, thank you as well.
Thanks so much.
We'll have them both back sooner rather than later, I'm sure. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation, and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.